Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. Today is the 12th of March, 2015, here in Japan, and today we're joined on the line from the United States by Peter Kirby. And people might remember Peter from a conversation that we had way back in 2012 on Corbett Report Radio number 232, which I will link up in the show notes for those who haven't caught that conversation or haven't listened to it in a while. That was a pretty extensive conversation on the topic of weather modification geoengineering for financial gain, talking about an article that Peter wrote back a few years ago on the history of weather derivatives and how Enron and all of those players are tied up in this geoengineering chemtrailing agenda that we see unfolding before us. But Peter is back with an even more detailed and very, very fascinating article called Chemtrails Exposed, A History of the New Manhattan Project, that's available on activistpost.com, which I will also link up in the show notes, as well as Peter's e-book, Chemtrails Exposed, A New Manhattan Project, available from Kindle for as little as 98 cents. So please do check that out. And there's going to be a lot more to come with regards to this information. So Peter, thank you so much for joining us on the program again today. It's good to talk to you.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Well, this is obviously such an important topic and one that has been so widely ridiculed in, of course, any mainstream discourse. The idea of chemtrails or weather modification or geoengineering is some sort of taboo conspiracy subject that we're not supposed to talk about. Specifically, of course, because, like so many other taboo conspiracy subjects, there is a lot of documentable information backing this up. And as I say, you do a great job of talking about this history in your Chemtrails Exposed article on Activist Post, starting way back even well before the modern scientific era, talking about the origins of weather modification and even back to early American involvement going back to the 18th century. Perhaps you can talk about some of that pre-modern history of the idea of weather modification, just so we have that background.
Sure, yeah, let's talk my paper. I'm trying to, I hope, it's really complex, you know, this whole thing. And I'm trying to talk to the reader and present the information in a way that people are going to understand. And so this article, what we're trying to concentrate on here, I'm trying to give this project a name. It doesn't really have a name. There's been speculation that I can't confirm about it being called Project Cloverleaf and whatnot. But, you know, I think if you really look at it objectively, there's no other name to call it except the New Manhattan Project. The similarities are just extensive, and they're actually outlined in my ebook. But, yes, the desire to modify the weather is as old as humanity itself. I mean, you know, if you're a farmer, like many people have been throughout history, you know, of course, you want the perfect weather. You want the perfect timing for the rain and the perfect timing for the sun and the perfect timing for everything. And, you know, I think man has often, especially in times when the weather has turned against him, man has had a desire to control the weather. And I'm not saying that this is the only purpose of the New Manhattan Project. That's why I call it the New Manhattan Project, because I don't call it just the Global Weather Modification Project, because there are many agendas going on here. But the most provable and the most documented is weather modification. And I believe that's where most of the money has been spent as well. So, yeah, let's go back to the origins of weather modification, which is a subheading in my article. And a lot of this stuff, my two best sources for this type of information were Professor James Fleming's book, Fixing the Sky, and another book by I think his name was D.H. Halasy, and he wrote a book called The Weather Changers, where they talk about, go into detail about these sort of shamanistic ways of trying to control the weather in the prehistorical times and then on through to the beginning of the scientific era in 1946. But, okay, so, yeah, you know, we say here in the paper, I mostly quote Professor Fleming's book, where he writes about in ancient Greece, there were what they called hail wardens, which would watch for hail and then signal to farmers, and they would be offering blood sacrifices and even, you know, draw their own blood or whatever was needed. You know, they were willing to kill a lot of things to get some rain going on there, apparently. And then, you know, in Austria, Professor Fleming writes about the ringing of these so-called thunder bells and weather horns, and women would rattle chains and beat milk pails to scare away the destructive spirit of the storm. I'm quoting directly from Mr. Fleming's book right there. And so, you know, the whole history of weather modification is steeped in this kind of, you know, pseudoscience, and a lot, there's quite a bit of con artistry, as we're about to see. The next subheading in the article is early American involvement. And, you know, there was a movie about early American involvement. It actually, I'm not sure when. Oh yeah, I think it took place in like the 50s. But these type of people, they were called rainmakers. And the movie that I'm referencing was called The Rainmakers. And the movie talked about this small group of men that were traveling around the West, and they happened upon towns that were in drought. They would go to regions where there was drought, and they would go to the local town hall, and they would, you know, like at a community meeting, and they would say, you know, we can make it rain, you know, scrape up a few thousand dollars and we'll go about making it rain. We'll save all your crops. And it was just pure con artistry, pure pseudoscience. And, you know, next thing you know, they're breaking out toxic chemicals and just releasing them everywhere, just as they do today. Although this isn't, you know, the program that they have today is actually scientific, and I believe they are quite successful in doing what they're doing. But they had no regard for people's health or, you know, pretty much anything that had gotten in the way of what they were trying to accomplish. And there was one guy in particular named, Robert St. George Dyrenforth, who was the first person to attain federal dollars, federal funding for this type of pseudoscientific activity. He performed some supposed weather modification efforts in Texas in 1891. And there were funds that came down from the Department of, through appropriated by the Congress, and came down through with $9,000 appropriated by the Congress, came down through the Department of Agriculture. And Dyrenforth, all he really did was just, he floated balloons, he flew kites, he blew up dynamite, you know, that was probably attached to the kite or whatnot. He used mortars, they just fired up into the air and had them explode, you know, a few hundred feet in the air. And what else here? Smoke bombs, fireworks. This type of idea that explosives cause precipitation is it goes back quite a ways, and it's very prevalent in this era of pseudoscientific weather modification. There was quite a bit written about how many generals historically. I believe this is in Professor Fleming's book. Many war generals believed that there was always precipitation after a battle, but of course it's totally unscientific, these claims, and can be debunked quite easily. But it was an idea that was pretty prevalent back then. And there was also someone who was the first meteorologist in U.S. government service, a guy by the name of James Pollard Espy, who died in 1860. He was known as the Storm King, and he believed that fires caused precipitation, forest fires and brush fires and things. He wrote a big book described by Professor Fleming as his magnum opus, and James Pollard Espy's book was titled The Philosophy of Storms. And it had a long section entitled Artificial Rains. And although he never received funding for this type of pseudoscientific weather modification, he was adamant about it his whole life. And as you can see, wrote quite a bit about it as well. And then as we move on, around that same time was when Nikola Tesla started laying the groundwork for what eventually became the New Manhattan Project. So he didn't, you know, of course, well, he did, you know, I've read one book on Tesla, and I've read some of his patents. And it's a little unclear to me right now as to exactly what the extent of his involvement in specifically in weather modification is. But the author, Margaret Cheney, of the one book that I've read so far, and I intend to read a lot more about Tesla. Margaret Cheney wrote a book called Tesla, Man Out of Time. And she says, this is one of the leading books on Tesla. And she says that Tesla often theorized about weather control. And he hypothesized that the Earth may be illuminated. The entire Earth might be illuminated by shooting electromagnetic energy 35,000 feet up into the atmosphere. 35,000 feet is about the altitude of today's ascending planes. So that may be significant. I'm not sure, but I do know that Nikola Tesla pioneered the use of two types of electromagnetic energy that are used in the New Manhattan Project, used by ionospheric heaters such as HARP. This is ELF waves, which stands for extremely low frequency waves, and VLF waves, which stands for very low frequency electromagnetic energy. Should I continue?
So that's excellent. Excellent summary of thousands of years of history, as you say, and that leads us right up to the doorstep of the modern era of weather modification. And as you say, I think there's some interesting things that we can take away from those stories from history, including the fact that there was a lot of charlatanry and people trying to scam a quick buck in this subject back in the day, and presumably those types still hover around us. But obviously we have moved into a scientific era that is much more capable of actually influencing weather patterns. So you note 1946 as the date that the modern scientific era of weather modification begins. What actually occurred in 1946?
Well, let me preface it with these two facts. Nikola Tesla died in 1943. So this is 3 years after Nikola Tesla died. That's plenty of time to go through his papers, which were confiscated by the FBI, were confiscated by the government. And then the other notable fact is that 1946 was 1 year after the atomic bombs had been dropped on Japan. So the United States government had this whole secret scientific apparatus in place when they dropped the bomb on Japan. And then maybe they thought to themselves, you know, they had this information from, I'm just theorizing here. And I intend to do some more of this. I intend to write more about this. I'm just kind of letting it go in the interview. Maybe they had all this information. Maybe they had Nikola Tesla's plans for weather modification. And, you know, after they dropped the bomb and they, you know, maybe the powers that be thought to themselves, well, you know, we have all this stuff on weather control. It wouldn't be great to control the weather. You know, we have all these scientists working for us. They're all in place. They all know how to keep a secret. You know, why not launch a weather modification endeavor? Anyway, so yeah, 1 year after the atomic bombs were dropped on Japan, here comes this huge public relations effort, this huge story. It was a big deal back in 1946 when three scientists from General Electric Laboratories, headed by the Nobel Peace Prize winning chemist, Irving Lang Muir, who died in 1957. He headed the group. He had two underlings by the name of Vincent Schaefer and Bernard Vonnegut. You can forget about Vincent Schaefer. He was like the guy that, you know, comes out and makes nice with everybody. He apparently was very sociable and, you know, he's a good front guy. But Lang Muir, of course, looks to me like he was heavily involved. He wrote a lot about weather modification. Basically, the whole latter part of his career was devoted to weather modification. He was absolutely consumed by it. He wrote all kinds of books. They're quite rare, and I haven't read those yet, but he was definitely on top of weather modification. And, you know, being that he was a chemist, Maybe he had something to do with concocting the sprays that we're seeing today. We do know that Langmuir and Vonnegut, Schaefer had something to do with it too, but basically the two guys are Langmuir and Vonnegut who we should be looking at. Anyway, the trio came up with the industry standard that we see today, silver iodide. That since 1946, that spray has been the spray of choice of the what I call the conventional weather modification industry. Although I don't agree with spraying anything out of planes, over people on the earth, the conventional weather modification industry is regulated by the government on a state-to-state basis. You have to get a certain permit, and this is what we refer to as cloud seeding. And sometimes they drop dry ice and lead iodide. All this stuff was pioneered and made famous by the three scientists from the General Electric labs. This is back in the day when it was pretty much private industry, what passes for private industry was developing all the technology. These days, everything comes out of the government. Everything comes out of the military. Back in 1946, it was corporations that had their own R&D labs that were doing this work. And so it was logical for this to come out of a corporation. Anyway, so Langmuir was there. He loved it. But the guy who was really involved in the New Manhattan Project, see, both of these things were born at the same time. Both the conventional weather modification industry and the New Manhattan Project were born from these three scientists at General Electric Laboratories. And so I intend to largely disregard the conventional weather modification industry. And the guy who went forward out of those three with the New Manhattan Project was Bernard Vonnegut. And I'll just tell everybody off the top, yes, he was Kurt Vonnegut's brother.
Thank you for clarifying that, because that is the first question everyone will have.
Yeah, I often have to just gloss over that because it just seems like a fact that's going to, distract people, because it's just a little bit of trivia that really doesn't have any pertinence to the whole thing. But he was, what's his name now? Bernard Vonnegut was Kurt Vonnegut's brother. And he started doing these things called space charge experiments. And this is where they would string a stainless steel wire, I believe uncoated, unsheathed, across miles of telephone poles. And this stainless steel wire would be connected to a power source. It would be, I believe, a significant power source, a very powerful, like power plant power source. And the current would be run through the wire in sufficient power to create coronal discharge, which is like where, you see Nikola Tesla in these rooms and there's all these bolts of electricity flying all over the place. And so that's coronal discharge. And they would wait until there would be big clouds going over. And I have a picture of this in the paper here. It was kind of weird. It was the cover of a book that was about atmospheric sciences, but I don't think this book, maybe, I don't know if it said anywhere in it about space charges. Anyway, I knew that the cover of the book was a space charge experiment. The rest of it was just scientific gobbledygook. But anyway, Bernard Vonnegut and some other scientists were working for this research and development corporation. It was outsourced work. They worked for this corporation called Arthur D. Little. Now, they're still around today. You can go to their website. If you search Arthur and then middle initial D and then last name Little, they're a research and development firm over there in either in Cambridge, Massachusetts, if I'm not mistaken, or somewhere near there. And all this work was funded by the government. And Vonnegut and he was basically the man in all this, so he had underlings pretty much. So Vonnegut and his underlings performed these space charge experiments from 1953 to 1961 in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Texas, Illinois, and New Mexico. They were supported by the U.S. Signal Corps and the U.S. Coast Guard. And I should also note that a lot of the original work of the trio from General Electric, Langmuir, Schaefer, and Vonnegut, was supported by the Navy and the Air Force as well. So there's been, starting in 1946, there's been huge military involvement in all this. And let's get back to Vonnegut. Yeah, he did all these space charge experiments. He also wrote a paper along with, three other guys, including Vincent Schaefer, who was, one of the three original. And in 1958, this foursome headed by Vonnegut wrote a paper that appeared in a big weather modification report. It was called the Final Report of the Advisory Committee on Weather Control. This was like a big, big deal. This is one of the most referenced early documents regarding weather control. And in this book that I have, it's like a small phone book, there was an article entitled The Future. And let me just quote directly from that. It reads, "When the nature of thunderstorm electrification is understood, it may prove possible to control this process by the introduction of chemicals into the atmosphere or by altering electrical variables. Such variables might be atmospheric conductivity, field and space charge, or perhaps the corona-giving properties of the Earth's surface." Next paragraph. "When we become sufficiently sophisticated concerning the dynamics of the atmosphere, it is possible that weather may be controlled by the large-scale release of chemical or more probably thermonuclear heat energy." So they're talking about the New Manhattan Project here, and that's what the New Manhattan Project is. It's injecting particles into the atmosphere. I prefer to use the term saturating the atmosphere with particles. And in this case, we know that the particles are metallic particles. The number one ingredient, aluminum. Number two ingredient, barium. Number three, strontium. This has been confirmed many, many times, probably thousands of times all over the world. So the New Manhattan Project is the saturation of our atmosphere with these conductive particles, and then the use of electromagnetic energy from ground-based antennas known as ionospheric heaters. This is what the energy from the ionospheric heaters manipulates the particles in the atmosphere. It can, by manipulations of the troposphere, the stratosphere, and the ionosphere, I'm aware, they speak of three different ways. I'm aware of two, pressure and heat effects are the two that I'm aware of. They also speak of Rabborn, who I'm about to get to, Admiral Rabborn. He speaks of acoustic effects. And this is really heavy scientific stuff, and I thank God I have somebody helping me with this. But basically, that's the New Manhattan Project, is saturation of the atmosphere with metallic particles influenced by electromagnetic energy. The conventional weather modification industry doesn't do that. They don't use ground-based antennas to manipulate the silver iodide or the dry ice that they dump out of planes. They just dump stuff into clouds. That's all they do. But this is what distinguishes the New Manhattan Project, is this use of electromagnetic energy in particular. Okay, so, they wrote a paper where they generally give a synopsis of the project here. But then the most ominous thing that Bernard Vonnegut ever did, I don't know about ever, but at least that I'm aware of, he wrote a paper in, 1961 called, Research in Electrical Phenomena Associated with Aerosols. This had to be translated from scientists to English for me by a career scientist. I mentioned that I have somebody who's helping me with the scientific aspects of all this. And so this was another report that was done, outsourced Arthur D. Little again, who had been doing the space charge experiments all along. And Vonnegut wrote it with a couple of guys named Arnold W. Doyle and D. Reed Moffitt. Came out in 1961, Research in Electrical Phenomena Associated with Aerosols. You can get it for free off the internet. They sell it on Amazon for like $110. And I'll admit something to the audience. I purchased it for $100 like 2 years ago. I didn't know it was available for free, but you can get it for free as a PDF download, and it is the exact same report. Now, this is where it gets interesting. On page four, let me just read from this here. I know you're sharp, James, so you're gonna understand this immediately, but it took me a while to figure it out. All right, here we go. Let me just read here on page four. This is pretty dark stuff, but you know, it has to be exposed. We have to look at the darkness in order to appreciate the light. So here we go. This is, I'm quoting from this report written by Vonnegut in 1961. Quote, one can make an estimate of the concentration of the field around an object or man by considering the potential in space in which it exists. For example, in a field of 100 volts, and then there's some scientific stuff here I don't really understand, but it says, in a field of 100 volts, a man's head is in a region where the potential is about 20,000 volts with respect to ground. Because of the relatively high conductivity of the body, the man's head is at ground potential, and therefore a corresponding amount of charge has passed from the ground up to his head. If we approximate the head as a sphere of 10 centimeters radius, its capacity is about 10 to the negative 11 farads. So the induced charge on it is about 2 times 10 to the negative 7. There's some boring stuff here. Accordingly, we see that the field and hence the rate of aerosol deposition should be about 20-fold greater on the man's head than on the ground. Okay, translation. They're talking about the effects of electromagnetic energy upon a man's head and the relation between that energy being applied to the head and how it works out with the ground, which is the body, which is standing on the earth. And the rest of the paper outlines what they were doing, and I write this in the article. The report was about their experiments of the previous 3 months involving the effects of electromagnetic energy upon a grounded sphere in a small chamber surrounded by gas. So this sphere that they're talking about, which had a ground attached to it, was a little metal sphere, I think it was metal, inside of a box with a ground wire attached to it. And they would pump in gas into this box and saturate the atmosphere around the sphere and then shoot electromagnetic energy at it. And in the literature, they're talking about the sphere as a man's head. So, I mean, you know, we're putting two and two together here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I had no idea about the existence of this this report, but I'm just looking at it now, and there it is. Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Great. Yeah, I've been flogging this report a little bit because I noticed when I released the article, there were some people, and you know, I'm not saying these people were trolls. They could have been genuinely concerned, and this was their thought. There were some people writing that, it can't be just a one trick pony here. You know, it's not all just about weather modification. You know, and I think they might have said, you know, there's some mind control aspects going on here. So I immediately started, saying, yes, you know, you're right. I do believe there are, that's what I'm saying now. I do believe there are many other aspects to the New Manhattan Project, many other agendas going on. And actually, the mind control aspects of the New Manhattan Project may be the primary reason for its existence. If you could really control people's minds and just have them as robots, just going around doing whatever you want, I mean, that's more powerful than controlling the weather, if you ask me.
Well, even declassified research that I highlighted in my most recent podcast episode absolutely admits, I mean, it's 100% admitted that there's been a lot of research and experimentation into manipulating people's moods, emotions, and perceptions through that type of brainwave technology. And so, obviously, if there's some sort of system for doing that at a distance via electromagnetic manipulation of the atmosphere or what have you, then obviously there's, I mean... the military aspects of this do not need to be elaborated on, I think. But I think something that maybe does need to be elaborated on, you point out that this started with that trio of scientists working in the GE labs at a time when there was still some sort of distance between the corporate aspect of this and the military aspect. When and how did the military start appropriating this technology in this research?
Well, I think they've just been there all along, really. They needed to support, you know, they've been there providing support to a lot of this stuff. Maybe speculating here, maybe, you know, they started out as just giving support to this stuff because, you know, they saw it as a matter of national importance. But then as time went on, they probably saw just how powerful all this stuff is. And you know, and then of course they start talking about how, well, we don't want the Russians to get it before us. And, you know, it's a matter of national security.
Right. And if the Manhattan Project analogy holds, then obviously, I mean, it's a military sort of aspect of it from the beginning, and obviously placed in that Cold War context. Let's go through some of the examples, though, just to flesh out for people who haven't read the article, that there is a lot of U.S. naval and other research that overlaps with this and takes up from it, including U.S. Naval Institute proceedings and other journal articles. Let's go through some of that evidence.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that the two most important points that the article makes is about Vonnegut and how that was the official kickoff of the whole deal. And then, because I didn't hear anybody talking about Vonnegut before, he is absolutely key to this thing. He was one of the pioneers. But there's somebody else who was even more important to the New Manhattan Project, in my view, who nobody has talked about except me. I'm not trying to toot my own horn, you know, James. I just want the spring to stop. But when I came on your show 2 or 3 years ago, that was the first time, to my knowledge, that anybody had ever uttered the name William Francis Rabbaugh. And my research indicates that this guy was the most important man in the history of the New Manhattan Project. I don't think that he would have been allowed to publish what he published in January of 1963 in the U.S. Naval Institute proceedings if he wasn't the man running the show. You see, because by him printing this, by him writing this and having it, I mean, we assume he wrote it, and having it published under his name, he's going to take the fall for if anything goes wrong. He's compromising himself. He's putting his chips down on the table. He's saying that, you know, here's my chips. You know, I'm either going to, you know, win a bunch here or I'm going to lose my butt. And I think that, you know, the powers that be kind of wanted to have a fall guy in case the whole thing got exposed. You know what I mean? And he exposed it all in 1963. Here we go. I quoted from his this before, but I didn't have the whole article last time I was on your show. I got it through an interlibrary loan. It's pretty easy to get, actually. It's available on worldcat.org. People don't know that website out there. I highly recommend you bookmark that. That's how you get interlibrary loans. That's how you get all these documents. The vast majority of this stuff is not on the internet. You have to get it through interlibrary loans. Anyway, in 1963, how about I just read all this? Because it's kind of long. It's about five or six paragraphs, but he just reveals the whole project here. I mean, this is it. I mean, so let me just read it. And this is 1963. I mean, it's a long time ago, but he's talking about the same thing that they're talking about in Owning the Weather 2025, which is, you know, the seminal document referred to today. So let's just read what Admiral William Francis Rabaun wrote in his paper in 1963 called New Horizons of Naval Research and Development. And he wrote this section under the heading of Environmental Warfare. It sounds like really pleasing, happy subject, doesn't it? Anyway, this is what he wrote. Quote, the possibilities for the military employment of the, quote, weather weapon may be as diverse as they are numerous. An ability to control the weather could introduce greater changes in warfare than those which occurred in 1945 with the explosion of the first nuclear weapons. So see right there, he's drawing a parallel to the original Manhattan Project. And boy, these weather modifiers and geoengineers over the year, they love to make comparisons to atomic bombs and then the original Manhattan Project and stuff. I mean, if you read my ebook, there's a bunch of stuff in there, all these different instances of geoengineers and military people and weather modification people, all referring to the original Manhattan Project and the explosion of nuclear weapons. I mean, they actually did it as well. They ignited nuclear bombs in the atmosphere. I could go back to that. But anyway, okay, so the second paragraph. This is United States Admiral William Francis Rabaun in 1963, back to what he says. He says, a severe storm or hurricane striking a naval force may well inflict greater damage than could an enemy. The capability to change the direction of destructive storms and guide them toward an enemy. Concentrations may exist in the future arsenal of the naval tactical commander. Ground, sea, air, and amphibious operations might be supported by the dissipation of fog or clouds or by the production of rain or drought. Conversely, the creation of solid, low overcasts might be used to conceal troop concentrations, movements, and task force deployments. Large-scale weather control techniques might be used to cause extensive flooding in strategic areas, or even to bring a new ice age upon the enemy. By influencing the ionosphere and atmosphere simultaneously, magnetic, acoustic, and pressure effects might be generated in such a way that ocean-wide sweepings of mines would occur. Creating or dissipating atmospheric temperature and humidity ducts might modify the refractive index of the atmosphere enough to influence radar or radio transmission. Artificially induced ionospheric storms might produce a blackout of communications. Certain electromagnetic waves are unable to pass through an area of precipitation. A cloud seeding generator could be employed under appropriate meteorological conditions to produce precipitation that would interfere with the operation of radio-guided or remotely controlled devices or vehicles. We already have taken our first steps toward developing an environmental warfare capability. We are using satellite weather data from TIROS 2 for current tactical operations and more accurate long-range weather predictions. Some experiments in fog dissipation have shown promise, and some exploratory research has been conducted on ways to change the heading of major storms. For these reasons, and because our advances in science make it reasonable, we are now engaged in planning a 10-year comprehensive study of the atmosphere, a study which we will designate ATMOS, A-T-M-O-S. This plan will be coordinated with our TENOC oceanographic studies, T-E-N-O-C. I, of course, looked, and that's the end of the quotation. I, of course, looked for the ATMOS program, and I have found nothing. I intend to keep looking. I would presume that there is some documentation of this ATMOS program somewhere in some naval library, but it's not available through an interlibrary loan.
Well, that brings us to 1963, and unfortunately, due to time constraints on my side, we're going to have to start wrapping up this conversation, but perhaps you can tell us just briefly about the history from 1963 forward and how that played into, eventually, the idea to control the weather by 2025.
Okay. Yeah, I researched the whole history of weather modification. There were plenty of documents. I made my own books. I did photocopies. I made thousands of photocopies, turned them into books. I bought all kinds of books from Amazon. We're talking a stack of documents over a yard high. And through searching all of this stuff, I mean, I pored over these things. It wasn't like I just glanced at them. It took forever. I mean, if you ever read government documents, you can pretty much understand how boring this work must have been. I'm so glad it's over. But anyway, one of the greatest sources of information on the New Manhattan Project appears in this series of reports by the Interdepartmental Committee on Atmospheric Sciences, otherwise known as the ICAS, I-C-A-S. And they produced reports on a semi-annual basis between 1960 and 1978. They produced about 20 reports. And there's quite a few instances of saturation of the atmosphere with particles and the use of electromagnetic energy. In other words, the New Manhattan Project. I have about four or five different instances that are taken from the ICAS reports. I found a doozy here. This one I sort of rehashed a couple of things, but I gave an in-depth analysis of the patents, the Chang patent, the stratospheric Welsbach seeding for reduction of global warming. I'm largely just repackaging. Well, there's new information in here as well, but I'm also repackaging it all into a way that people understand. So I had to include that part. But I also found a document here that may have been known in the chemtrail community. I'm not sure, but there was a 1994 document by Stanford Research International called Multiple Instrument Studies of Chemical Releases and Heating at Arecibo. Arecibo is an ionospheric heater in Puerto Rico. And they talk about in the report releasing three different releases of 48 kilograms each of barium, which they shot up there in rockets, and the rocket exploded and the barium cloud came out, and then they hit it with electromagnetic energy and turned it into a plasma. I mean, our whole atmosphere is a plasma right now with what they're doing, with the saturation of our atmosphere and then hitting it with the electromagnetic energy. I mean, we are breathing in a toxic plasma slurry every day. And it's just, you know, I just want it to end. But then I also go on, I do an in-depth analysis of the Owning the Weather 2025 document. I also include, there was a document in that set. Owning the Weather document was part of a larger set of 25 documents. And there was another document in that set called An Operational Analysis for Air Force 2025, where they also describe the New Manhattan Project's As we know it. And then the last thing that I reference in the paper is the paper written by Edward Teller, Lowell Wood, and Roderick Hyde for the Lawrence Livermore Laboratories. This was not, although many people have been aware of this, I wasn't fully aware of it. They're talking about just spraying aluminum over everybody. And the quote from it here is alumina, which is, you know, any form of aluminum, could be, you know, different oxides and whatnot. Alumina, like sulfate, is ubiquitous in the terrestrial biosphere, and its stratospheric injection seemingly poses no significant environment issues. So, I mean, you know, they just say it, and it must be so. I mean, you know, they're scientists. You know, just go ahead and spray us with all this aluminum, I guess, you know, because, you know, well, there's a lot of it in dirt, so I guess can't hurt that bad. I guess that's what they're saying, you know. But I demur.
Yes, indeed. Trust the experts. What could go wrong? Well, I hope that at the very least this piques people's interest in the article itself, which is extremely detailed. And there's a lot of links to a lot of different resources here, articles, patents, a lot of specific information that we didn't have time to go into in detail, but it is there in that article. And of course, also in the ebook, Chemtrails Exposed. I'm assuming that this is sort of the history and the background, but I'm assuming you're concentrating your research these days on what's going on at the moment. Tell us about Chemtrails Exposed and how that ebook is going to evolve from here.
Yeah. Thanks for asking that, because I wanted to get this point across. Yeah, where I'm going with this is this year I'm going to be writing papers regularly. They're going to be coming out probably about every 2 months or so, hopefully more like every 1 month. But anyway, I'm working as hard as I can, and it's going to cover all the aspects of this. The first three chapters are going to remain the way they are. But then starting with chapter four, I'm going to start detailing each aspect. I mean, the project has aspects, right? One of the aspects of the project would be the ionospheric heaters, the ground-based antennas. Another aspect would be the spray itself, which I can write a pipe paper on that. Another aspect would be the planes themselves. So, you know, there would also be a whole command and control apparatus behind it, which I'm going to write about that. And then I'll write a paper about, you know, biological impacts. I'll write a paper about solutions. And I'm going to write one about conclusions. See, right now, I'm just trying to build a body of evidence. I'm kind of dropping little hints here and there, but when I write the conclusions paper is when I really lay it out and when I'll really say what I think is going on. Right now I'm just trying to stick with stuff I can prove. But over time, throughout this entire year, last year I was doing something else with like a local political activism stuff and writing some other things. But this whole year I'm dedicating myself to chemtrail research. And by the time my paper is done, I'm going to be adding, you know, every time I write a paper, it's going to be a new chapter in the book, and I'll release the paper through activistpost.com. But by the time I write all the papers and have them all included in the ebook, it's going to be comprehensive. And I'm frankly a little scared as to the things that I'm going to have to write about once I, compile all the evidence. I do want to get into persons of interest at some point. I do want to get into organizations of interest at some point. But that's all down the line. I want to be able to say, you know, without a doubt as to, you know, who it is involved here. I can say names of corporations right now. I mean, we know that it's Raytheon behind all the electromagnetic energy stuff. I mean, they have all the patents on that stuff, and they've that's their whole company. What Raytheon translates to, it means light from the gods. And one of the aspects of the New Manhattan Project may be Nikola Tesla's death ray, which would basically be just a lightning bolt coming out of the sky and just zapping whatever person that they want. And maybe that's been the purpose of Raytheon all along, being that their name is Light from the Gods. And wouldn't that be a powerful weapon to have in your arsenal?
It certainly would, and it would play into a lot of other agendas that we've talked about before, like false flag, if not alien invasions. How about a false flag God invasion? And it sounds ridiculous, but those are the types of things.
Yeah, I'm aware of Project Bluebeam.
Right.
We know Sergey Manost and what happened to him. And we know the woman from the Disclosure Project who said over and over many times that Wernher von Braun, the famous rocket scientist, told her many times that the last card that the establishment is going to play is a fake alien invasion. And this type of technology, the electromagnetic energy, which my source tells me is, quote, the fabric of space and time. This type of technology plays right into a phony alien invasion.
Well, fascinating stuff. And for your own personal safety, obviously, the best way to protect yourself is to make it all public and keep your research open and public and don't have any hidden sources, because that's when people tend to end up missing and suicided in elaborate ways. So hopefully that will not be an issue for you as you are putting this out, as you say, at Activist Post and also through Chemtrails Exposed, the ebook, which, as I say, is available through Kindle for automatic download right now for less than $1. So I hope people will check into that. The links, of course, in the show notes, as well as to links to all of the stuff that we've been talking about today. Peter Kirby, fascinating conversation. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to talk about in the future. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you for your time.
Oh, you're welcome, James.